Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
On this 18th anniversary, 9/11, the U.S. remembers the nearly 3,000 men, women, children, and first responders who lost their lives in the largest and deadliest attack on U.S. soil ever. We pay tribute to the fallen and explore how America should rightly understand the costly and bloody wars in the Middle East that have followed. Please give us a subscribe, a 5-star rating, and get your friend to do the same. Leave a review. This is Charlie Kirk, host of The Charlie Kirk Show, your home of conservative, libertarian, rational thinking. Here we go.
Charlie, what you've done is incredible here.
Maybe Charlie Kirk is on the college campus.
I want you to know we are lucky to have Charlie Kirk.
Charlie Kirk's running the White House, folks.
I want to thank Charlie. He's an incredible guy. His spirit, his love of this country. He's done an amazing job building one of the most powerful youth organizations ever created, Turning Point USA.
We will not embrace the ideas that have destroyed countries, destroyed lives, and we are going to fight for freedom on campuses across the country. That's why we are here.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to this edition of the Charlie Kirk Show. 18 years ago today, it kind of really struck me that some people listening to this podcast were not alive 18 years ago to this day. It is our generation's equivalent of Pearl Harbor, a horrendous, unforgivable attack on our nation, on our sovereignty, on our values, on our way of life, on our civilization, and on our culture. Where were you 18 years ago? Well, I'll tell you exactly where I was. I was in my second grade classroom. There's not much I remember from second grade, but I remember every detail of September 11th, 2001. I remember getting to school unusually early. My parents dropped me off at Quest Academy in Palatine, Illinois. I went into my second grade class, Mrs. Drost, and the day started like any other. And then I remember Miss Drost being called out into the hall by our administrator or principal or some equivalent of that. She then came back in, and I remember she just looked flustered. I remember somebody asked her what was going on, and she just continued to teach the class. And then a dear friend of mine, who remains a great friend to this day, who's just a terrific guy, Alex, came storming into the classroom. And he said, "Everybody, everybody, the Twin Towers in New York City have been hit. We are under attack." Now, mind you, in second grade, you don't really grasp what that means. You don't really understand the depth or the breadth of what it means to be attacked as a country. And I remember he just kept saying it over and over again. Now, Alex, interestingly enough, ended up becoming a pilot, and it was always known in our second grade class as loving aviation and just being super smart. And he was late to school that day, and he heard the reports on the radio that his mother told him. And then I remember we were unusually broke for recess, and we went outside, and out of nowhere, everyone started to get picked up from school. Everybody's parents started to come for school, one by one. And then my parents, you know, my mom picked me up, I think, around one or two, and I remember her just being so distraught, crying in the car, just a car ride home, and I tried to make conversation. My mom said, "We're not talking today. We're remembering what's happened today." It was just dead silence in the car. We drove home, got home. School was canceled the remainder of the week. Now, I want everyone listening to this to understand that there was such fear in the country at that moment that there would be more widespread terrorist attacks all across the country. And living in the suburbs of Chicago, there were plenty of newscasters and plenty of people that were saying, well, maybe it would be Chicago, maybe it would be San Francisco, maybe it would be Los Angeles. All flights were grounded for over a week. If my memory serves me correctly, at least a couple days, all flights were grounded across the country. I mean, there were horror stories of people that had to get, you know, take a flight to get across the country, and those flights were grounded, and they ended up in places unknown, and there were handicapped people that were left, you know, with only the people that they got to know on the plane landing in rural Oklahoma, because there was a grounding flight order. And then I remember in the days to come, school finally, of course, went back in session. We had, it was very, the administration went out of their way to explain what happened to us second graders. And I remember so vividly, the principal saying, "You will never forget this for the rest of your life." And we went through a prayer ceremony despite us being a secular school. So 9/11 was on a Tuesday, and they started flights on a Thursday and ramped up a few more flights again on Friday, 9/14. So my memory does serve me correctly that there was a total ground stop for at least a couple days. Almost everyone listening to this podcast, if you were probably kindergarten or older, you remember exactly where you were on 9/11. And for me, I remember the classroom. I remember the way the sun was shining through the window. I remember the way the teacher looked at me. I remember the way the classmates looked at each other. And understand, for those of you that are listening to this podcast that don't have any recollection of 9/11, we were a nation in shock. I have not lived through another event since September 11th, 2001 like that. So it is hard for me to be able to portray that. And mind you, I was only in second grade. There are plenty of people listening to this podcast that were 20 when it happened, or 30 when it happened, or in high school or in college, and everybody has their own particular story. So this podcast, we are going to dive, first and foremost, we're going to reflect on what happened. We're going to go through some of the unsung heroes and some of the heroes that should be remembered each and every September 11th, 2001. We are going to talk the specifics of what happened that horrible Tuesday morning. Then we're going to talk about some of the mistakes that we have made in the response to the greatest terrorist attack on American soil ever. And we're going to talk, we have an honest assessment, an honest autopsy of U.S. foreign policy ever since September 11th, 2001. And today, as you listen to this podcast, and for people that are listening to this podcast in the days to come, remember those that lost their lives, that just went to work in New York City, or those people that stood up courageously on United Flight 93. And we are going to remember those people today. But before we go any further, let's talk about football. Football is back. And guess what? The Oregon Ducks won 70-6, or like 77-6. The Ducks are back. I think the Ducks have a good chance, if they win out, of making the college football playoff. For those of you that don't know, my aunt, my uncle, and my father went to the University of Oregon. Go Ducks. There were some great games in college football this last weekend. Sorry for all the University of Texas fans out there. LSU had an unbelievable game. That quarterback that used to play for Ohio State, total stud. I don't remember his name, but something tells me I'm going to be remembering his name for quite some time. There was a great weekend of NFL football as well. I mean, the Patriots, it should be almost illegal to be this good. I mean, the Patriots are not supposed to be able to win 30-3, or whatever they won, 30-3 against Pittsburgh. I was really excited about this really competitive Sunday night matchup. I was so excited to see Roethlisberger and Brady battle it out, and then whatever. And I'm going to say it right here. I believe that the Patriots might have been back-channeling with Antonio Brown. It was a little suspicious how quickly he got cut by the Raiders and how quickly he got scooped up by the Patriots. I love the New England Patriots. I love Tom Brady. I always have. It's just kind of getting a little unfair. So I hope that some team can rise up and give them a run for their money. And of course, the San Francisco 49ers, my guy, Jimmy Garoppolo, who I grew up competing against, they of course won. So we got some big matchups. Got Minnesota at Green Bay, Kansas City at Oakland, Seattle at Pittsburgh this weekend, New Orleans at LA. I love New Orleans to pull off the upset there. Of course, we have Arizona State at Michigan State in college football. Iowa at Iowa State, always one of my most favorite games to watch. And Clemson goes to Syracuse to try to avenge the loss from 2 years ago. So get in on the action right now. For those of you that want to actually get engaged, get involved, and you have your own opinions of who you think is going to win, then you got to visit betonline.ag, and don't forget that promo code Podcast One for your 50% sign-up bonus. BetOnline.ag is the place to do it. Of course, Adam Carolla thinks he can pick games better than I can. Well, look, we have this $5,000 season-long charity contest, so you got to get in on the action. So here's a look. Here are my five picks of the week. Here we go. Minnesota, Green Bay. I like Minnesota to pull it off. Kansas City at Oakland. I like Kansas City. Seattle at Pittsburgh. I like Seattle. New Orleans at LA Rams. I like New Orleans. And Philadelphia at Atlanta. I like Philadelphia. Those are my picks for the week. And for those of you that might disagree, well, then put some money on it. Go to betonline.ag. Let's see for yourself. Let's see you put your money where your mouth is. Then you got to visit betonline.ag. And don't forget that promo code podcast1 for your 50% sign-up bonus. That is betonline.ag. All right, so now as we remember the events of that fateful day on September 11th, 2001. Now look, realizing that some of you that are in college right now, you were just 3 or 4 years old when this happened, and so you likely don't have a working memory of 9/11, only maybe what you've seen and heard in news reports. So let's remember exactly how that morning unfolded. At 7:59 a.m., the first plane, American Airlines 11, took off from Boston Logan Airport with 92 people on board. At 8:46 a.m., American Flight 11 slammed into the North Tower of the World Trade Center in New York City, killing everyone on board almost instantly. By now, the eyes of the world are fixed on the island of Manhattan. I remember my father told me this. Some people thought that this was just an aviation error. So they thought after some people watching and some people doing the news coverage, they thought it was just a plane error or it was an erratic pilot that might have been committing suicide. It was not clear that it was a terrorist attack until the second plane hit. At 9:03 a.m., a second plane, United Flight 175, barreled into the South Tower of the World Trade Center. And this is when all of a sudden everyone went into total freakout and panic mode. It was clear that the United States is under a coordinated attack.
Oh, my God.
Oh, my God.
That looks like a second plane.
I did not see a plane go in. That just exploded.
I just saw another plane coming in from the side.
You did. That was out of absolute.
Yes, and
my
that's
view.
The second explosion. You could see the plane come in just from the right-hand side of the screen. So this looks like it is some sort of a concerted effort to attack the World Trade Center that is underway in downtown New York.
So again, it was clear at that moment that the United States was under a coordinated attack. At 9:05 in an elementary school classroom in Florida, President George W. Bush is informed of the attacks by his chief of staff, Andy Card. By 9:30, the brave heroes of the New York Fire and New York Police Department have been on the scene of Ground Zero for at least 15 minutes, attempting to evacuate the workers left in the Twin Towers. Within hours of the attacks, a 200-unit search and rescue operation was long underway. Hundreds of miles away, at 9:37, American Flight 77 crashed into the Pentagon. So understand, for those of you that might have not been as well versed in this because you weren't alive during it, there were 4 plane hijackings happening basically simultaneously. There was one that eventually crashed into the Pentagon, 2 in New York City, and the 4th we'll talk about in particular, which in some ways has become the most infamous of the 4 of who we remember actually on the plane. By 10:03, the 4th plane hijacked by terrorists and reclaimed by brave Americans crashed into a field near Shanksville, Pennsylvania. This was United Flight 93. We'll talk about them in just a minute. And the final punctuation on September day occurred at 10:27 when the North Tower of the World Trade Center collapsed after burning for 102 minutes. Let's play clip number 2 of reporters reacting to the building falling.
The whole side has collapsed?
The whole building has collapsed.
The whole building has collapsed?
The building has collapsed. It pulled it down on itself.
You can see this extraordinary plume of smoke that is, or was at least, the second tower of the World Trade Center. You could, from where we were standing, see that second building, but you can't see it anymore.
In all, 2,997 people, it's just hard to say that number, were killed in the attacks. About 3,000 Americans were killed. Innocent Americans were killed in the attacks, and over 6,000 injured, making it the largest single instance of casualties on American soil in history. All 19 terrorists hijacked perished on 9/11. We don't count them in the amount of people killed. So 2,997 people were killed. Some people say that it's over 3,000. We intentionally subtract the number of the hijackers because they don't deserve to be remembered as victims. They were the perpetrators. What came next changed the entire course of history. To put this all in perspective, compare the loss of life of America's other great domestic attack in U.S. history, Pearl Harbor, on December 7, 1941. The total number of military personnel killed was 2,335, including 2,000 Navy personnel, 109 Marines, and 218 Army. Added to this were 68 civilians, making the total number 2,403 people died. The number of wounded came to 1,143. 9/11 was a bigger terrorist attack than Pearl Harbor. So let's take a moment to remember just some of the victims of September 11th attacks by honoring just a select few who perished that day. Danny Lewin, an Israeli-American who served in one of the most elite counterterrorism units of the IDF, the Israeli Defense Force, rose from his seat on American 11 and engaged one of the terrorist hijackers. He was killed on board that plane, making him the first victim of 9/11, the first casualty of the very first war of the 21st century. God bless him, and God bless Israel. Cece Lyles, a flight attendant and mother of four, who was on board flight United 93 and helped, along the rest of the flight crew, storm the terrorist hijackers and stop the plane from hitting its intended target in Washington, D.C., likely the White House or the Capitol. She could be heard phoning from the plane to send one last message to her husband. Disclaimer right now, this is very emotionally moving and could be traumatic audio. And so I just wanted to give that disclaimer. Let's listen to United 93 victim voicemail. It's very difficult to listen to this.
Tuesday, 9:47 a.m.
Hi, baby. You have to listen to me carefully. I'm on a plane that's been hijacked. I'm on the plane. I'm calling from the plane. I want to tell you I love you. Please tell my children that I love them very much. And I'm so sorry, babe. I don't know what to say. There's three guys, they've hijacked the plane. I'm trying to be calm. We're turned around, and I've heard that there's planes that's been flown into the World Trade Center. I hope to be able to see your face again, baby. I love you. Bye.
End of message.
In the immediate aftermath of the attacks, firefighters and law enforcement officials from across the country took weeks off of work to travel to Ground Zero and assist with the cleanup, search and rescue, and body recovery. Millions of people from around the nation and the world have traveled to Ground Zero in New York City. I've been there. I encourage everyone listening to this podcast to go to New York to honor those who have lost their lives in the terrorist attack. The National September 11th Memorial Museum opened its doors to the public in 2014. Again, you have to check this out. There's more than 10,000 artifacts, 23,000 photographs, 1,900 oral histories, and 500 hours of video, all telling the story of what happened during the terrorist attacks. Artifacts in the 110,000-square-foot building range from steel beams, a mangled elevator motor, and a concrete staircase from the World Trade Center to a stuffed Peter Rabbit that belonged to a 2.5-year-old Christine Lee Hansen, an airplane passenger and the youngest victim of the 9/11 attacks. The museum also includes a portrait wall of 2,983 victims of the 9/11 attacks and the 1993 bombing of the World Trade Center, interactive displays, and recording of survivors. Exhibits tell the story of the first responders who sacrificed their lives to help others through the tragedy, including 343 firefighters, 60 police officers, and 8 paramedics who died instantly when the Twin Towers collapsed. They work for departments in New York or New Jersey. Some Americans are still choosing to honor the victims of 9/11 through service. According to the New York Post, on the eve of the 18th anniversary of September 11th, 2001 terror attacks, the current FDNY Academy class set to graduate in 2 weeks includes 13 members, 12 men and one woman, whose firefighter fathers were murdered on 9/11. And it's so important that we remember the heroism and the courage of the people from that day on September 11th, 2011. A lot of these firefighters were just going about doing their job, and they walked into the fire. They walked into the building. Police officers, paramedics, and they climbed stories after stories. There are stories of firefighters that went and retrieved dozens of people, yet kept running back into the building, And this was America at its best, American heroism at its best. And whether it be people, it just brings chills on that Flight 93. For those of you that don't know the story of Flight 93, please go watch the movie. Flight 93 was the last aircraft flying. And it was well known at that moment. The passengers had figured out, based on communicating to people back on the ground and the terrorists, that this plane was going to go down. And this plane was going to go down for a bad purpose. And so what did the Flight 93 people decide to do? They stormed the cockpit, crashing the plane down in rural Pennsylvania. It's 65 miles southeast of Pittsburgh and 130 miles northwest of Washington, D.C. This plane was headed to Washington, D.C. United Flight 93 was the only plane that did not reach its hijackers' intended target. These passengers knew they were going to die. These passengers knew that they were going to perish. And in an act of absolutely and just incredible heroism, they decided to storm the cockpit, take control of the plane in a sense that would make it crash in a rural area so that it wouldn't hit its intended target. We can only speculate what that intended target was. Some people believe it was the White House. Other people believe it was the Capitol building, but it was headed quickly to Washington, D.C. And in fact, the U.S. military was poised to shoot down this aircraft, to shoot down a civilian aircraft to try to prevent it from hitting other targets. So now, before we go any further, before I talk about the mistakes that America made since 9/11, before I talk about who was behind 9/11, and we talk about just some of the foreign actors that end up attacking our country, I just have to say, the most ridiculous conspiracy theories have risen out of the rubble of the World Trade Center attacks. They range in such ridiculousness, and I get these messages all the time from people. Just listen, I cannot say any more unequivocally, the conspiracy community behind 9/11 is one of the most frustrating of all the different conspiracy theories. And I could go piece by piece. I mean, some people think that a missile, not a plane, hit the Pentagon despite hundreds of lives lost and legitimate families that no longer have fathers. And that's just absolutely ludicrous. Some people say that the Israelis were behind 9/11. There's no evidence of that. There is no facts whatsoever behind that. Others claim that there were no planes at all, just missiles designed to resemble planes launched by the United States government. And so for those of you that are engaged in those nasty conspiracy theories, boy, do I oppose, disavow, and push back against those. They are baseless. They are without facts. And I just had to say this because so many people take to the conspiracy circuit on 9/11, and I find it reprehensible and detestable in every single capacity and every single regard. So now, back to just the facts and back talking about what actually happened on 9/11, it begs the question, who was really behind 9/11? Well, Senator Rand Paul, probably my favorite United States senator, has been on this tremendously. So Al-Qaeda, led by Osama bin Laden, and financed by who? Financed by the Saudis, according to documents obtained by the New York Times. Fact, bin Laden wanted to commit jihad against the West and especially America. Bin Laden believed he and his families were justified to attack the West because, in his view, the West was attacking Islam. Fact, he was opposed to the presence of Western, including American troops in Saudi Arabia, which is the Holy Land to Muslims. Fact, he also resented America for killing Muslims during the Persian Gulf War. Fact, he was previously responsible for bombing the World Trade Center in 1993. And so if you actually just look at the facts behind who were the 9/11 hijackers, 15 out of 19 of the hijackers were Saudi Arabian. And again, the documents obtained by the New York Times show clearly that the many members of the Saudi royal family were behind the funding of 9/11. They knew it was going to happen, and they supported it happening. Let's listen to Senator Rand Paul talking to my good friend, Eric Bolling, just about this exact issue.
Don't get me started on Saudi Arabia. I've been mad and angry and upset since 9/11. We tend to forget that most of the hijackers came from there. And then for the last couple of years, we've been involved with the war in Yemen, supporting Saudi Arabia, refueling their planes, giving them bombs. And we have over 10,000 civilians who have died there, and Congress has never voted on whether we should be there. I don't know how we can sell arms to a country like Saudi Arabia that really, they're the largest state sponsor of radical Islam in the world, and yet we continue to sell them arms. I'm for stopping it. So I've introduced legislation today to say that we shouldn't sell arms to Saudi Arabia.
So mind you, Senator Rand Paul also calls for the release of the classified 28 pages from the 9/11 Commission report in a bipartisan, bicameral press conference to unveil the Transparency for the Families and 9/11's Victims Act of 2015. The legislation called on President Obama to declassify the redacted 28 pages from the 9/11 Commission report. It died in the previous Congress. The bill was introduced on June 1st, 2015 in a previous session of Congress, but was not enacted. Let's listen to Senator Rand Paul talk about this from 2015.
Over a decade ago, a bipartisan congressional committee investigated the 9/11 attacks and wrote a report. 28 pages from that report have never been released to the public. We're here today to call for the release of those 28 pages. The survivors, civilian heroes, and families of the victims of September 11 terrorist attacks, some of whom are here today, deserve the full truth. I'm not alone in calling for the pages to be released. Over the 13 years since the report was completed, many have called for the release of these records, including former heads of the CIA, the Republican and Democrat heads of the 9/11 Commission. Even the Saudi government continues to favor the release of these pages. The co-sponsors of my bill are Senator Ron Wyden and Kirsten Gillibrand. We all are calling today for the release of these 28 pages. We are joined by bipartisan members of the House who have a similar bill. I especially want to thank my friend Walter Jones for encouraging me to learn more about this issue. 15 of the 19 hijackers were from Saudi Arabia. While their nationality alone does not constitute any wrongdoing by the Saudi government, information that has been revealed over the years does raise questions about their support and whether their support might have been provided to these Al-Qaeda terrorists.
Now look, Rand Paul is rightfully angry at the Saudis. They were never held accountable for what they did to our country on 9/11. It was the worst attack on American soil since Pearl Harbor and worse than Pearl Harbor. But Senator Rand Paul is rightfully questioning why we are selling arms to the very country and the royal family that was behind 9/11, that is still spreading Wahhabi ideology all across the globe. On this issue, Senator Rand Paul, I think, makes a terrific and important point. Why do we forget that it was Saudi Arabia that was behind the worst terrorist attack in American history, that 15 out of 19 of the hijackers were Saudi Arabian? And if we are looking for a way to fund the 9/11 Victims Memorial Fund, why not have Saudi Arabia, who have still not paid a price for what they did to our country on 9/11? For 15 out of 19 of the hijackers who were Saudi Arabian, they financed it, and according to the New York Times and the documents obtained by them, they were the ones that were behind it. So why is this important? Well, Senator Rand Paul said it best. This has far-reaching implications into the current geopolitical atmosphere and geopolitical circumstances that are happening in the Middle East today. And some of the same Saudi royals that were behind 9/11 are still in power today in Saudi Arabia. Senator Rand Paul, I totally and completely agree that we should not sell arms to these countries that continue to fund terror and behind some of these evil ideas that contributed to the terrorist attack on 9/11. So a lot of you listening that might not have been alive or even old enough to remember, 9/11 changed the entire structure of our government. It was a tectonic shift in even the way that we view foreign policy altogether. And we're going to dive into how much money we have spent on these foreign wars, the mistakes that we have made. But let's first talk about just the sacrificing of American privacy and our own individual rights. Look, in the immediate aftermath of the attack, Congress came together to pass the USA Patriot Act, which stands for the Uniting and Strengthening America by providing appropriate tools required to intercept and obstruct terrorism act. Wow, I wonder how long they spent on that acronym. The act allows federal officials greater authority in tracking and intercepting communications, both for purposes of law enforcement and foreign intelligence gathering, which essentially is the surveillance of American citizens. In 1996, Congress passed Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act of 1996 to make it easier for law enforcement to identify and prosecute domestic and international terrorists in the aftermath of the 1995 Oklahoma City bombings. President Clinton, at the time, dissatisfied with the law, asked Congress to include strengthened provisions for wiretapping and surveillance to give law enforcement increased access to domestic terrorism. Congress, at the time, refused, feeling that loosening surveillance and records rules would be unconstitutional. But after 9/11, all bets were off, and I'll tell you, this was a mistake. Sacrificing our Fourth Amendment just because something horrendous and unforgivable happens is not a trade that I'm comfortable with. For example, if in order to spy on a terrorist, get a warrant. Any judge worth their salt will approve a warrant on someone that is suspected of terrorism. In order to say that we should be able to tap into everyone's private phones, be able to tap into everyone's own communications, is an extraordinary abuse of power. And after the passage of the Patriot Act, there were leaks after leaks of how the Patriot Act was abused to go after people's private communications just because of the power that the federal government was able to wield. 11 days, another part of our government that did not exist is the Department of Homeland Security. A lot of people talk about the Department of Homeland Security, which oversees the southern border, and they oversee the TSA, the Transportation Security Administration, which we'll get to in a second. But no one really knows where the Department of Homeland Security actually came from. Well, 11 days after September 11, 2011, the terrorist attacks, Pennsylvania Governor Tom Ridge was appointed as the first director of Office of Homeland Security in the White House. The office oversaw and coordinated a comprehensive national strategy to safeguard the country against terrorism and respond to any future attacks. This was a huge mistake. So instead of actually going through and finding the mistakes that we made where the government agencies failed, we just created another government agency. So almost a year after 9/11, in November 2002, the Department of Homeland Security formally came into being as a standalone cabinet-level department to further coordinate and unify national Homeland Security efforts, opening its doors on March 1, 2003. Department of Homeland Security now has budgets in the tens of billions of dollars every single year. We just created an entirely new bureaucracy. We already had the Federal Bureau of Investigation. We had plenty of other agencies that were already supposed to be doing this work that received tips about 9/11 that didn't actually do their job. But instead of actually cleaning out those agencies, instead of actually going and firing people and holding them accountable, we just created another part of government. We proposed a whole new echelon of a broken federal government to just continue to infringe on our individual liberties, to continue to waste money and hire more bureaucrats that don't do much of anything all day. And look, now I'm going to go into something that I am absolutely, let's just say, passionate about, but I'm very upset about. I think this is one of the most unnecessary creations of the Department of Homeland Security, and one of the most ineffective, the one of the most constitutionally abusive, and one of the most ineffectual government agencies ever created in the history of government. And I deal with them almost every single day, 6 days a week I deal with them. And that is the TSA, the Transportation Security Administration. 2 months and 8 days after the 9/11 attacks, President Bush authorized the creation of the Transportation Security Administration. The department was initially housed under the Department of Transportation, but was moved to the newly created Department of Homeland Security in 2003. So let me just stop right here. We did not need to create an entire new agency, the Transportation Security Administration. We could have hired private security at every single airport that would do a much better job than TSA does, that would not be a permanent federal bureaucracy, and they could be independent contractors. Essentially, you would contract a security agency, and they would work to minimize waiting times. They would work to make sure they don't violate your constitutional liberties. And can I just say something? Who the heck thought it was a good idea to give a TSA agent a badge? I mean, they're not law enforcement officers. They have no enforcement capabilities, and they don't carry firearms. There are 47,000 TSOs. They're known as screeners, and they're employed across America. This is a waste of money. It's a waste of time. I mean, some are really nice people. I encounter them. They mean really, really well. But it's a totally unnecessary band of government that was created. There are ways to look through people's bags. There are ways to make sure that they don't go on an airplane without a firearm or a weapon, without having to create a 47,000-member government bureaucracy where you have to pay for their salaries, you have to pay for their pensions, you have to pay for their time off. They don't do anything half the time. I mean, I look at some of these this TSA bureaucracy. None of them are happy to be there, almost none of them. And the ones that are there, I appreciate the work and the service they do to our country. But just because something horrendous and something unforgivable happens to your country is not an excuse to grow government. Let me say that again. Just because something horrible happens and something unforgivable happens, and no, Ilhan Omar, some people did not just do something. It was something that should always be remembered and something that must be so close to our heart with reverence and reflection does not mean that we should go hire 47,000 people. And I get so upset because I travel 6 days a week and still people, they check out my bag, they check out my laptop. I mean, what do I have to prove that I am not a national security threat to the country? That I don't have to have my bag searched forensically every single time, and it stunts my travel time. And everyone listen to this, I'm sure you have had your own horror stories with the TSA. The pat downs that are totally unneeded, the ridiculous questions, the bad attitude, the unnecessary lines, the lack of spirit, the lack of energy that happens when the TSA exists. And this all happened because of 9/11. Air travel fundamentally changed because of 9/11. And our civil liberties diminished and decreased tremendously. And look, here's a challenge for all people listening to this podcast. When something bad happens, are you willing to say no to government growing when that bad thing happens? It is so tempting to want to grow government when a tragedy strikes. We find sometimes misleading comfort in government when something bad happens, that government can fix it or government can make this not happen again. I, for one, will fight at every single inch not to sacrifice my liberty for a false aberration of security. Not to mention the TSA doesn't even do their job. There was a study that goes to show, Mr. Producer will pull up the study, that out of a random check, TSA was not even doing their job, that people were getting firearms through, that people were getting water bottles through. Can I get a water bottle waiver? Have I earned the fact that I fly over 320 times a year? Can I get some sort of waiver from the federal government that I can bring a liquid onto the plane? And by the way, this is according to the Los Angeles Times, which is a fascinating article. TSA's 95% failure rate shows airport security is a charade, by David Horsey, June 9th, 2015. 95% failure rate. So not only do we grow government to try to pacify our fears and to try to make us feel better after a tragedy, but it doesn't even work. So we created a complete police state at our airports that fails 95% of the time, according to this Los Angeles Times article. So before we get into the foreign policy failures post 9/11, wouldn't it be nice if search engines and social media sites were unbiased platforms that didn't choose a side politically? Keep dreaming. In 2016, the tech elites at Google bragged about donating millions of dollars to Hillary Clinton. These big tech companies that push their political agenda and restrict the free speech rights of conservatives are the very same corporations we're trusting to handle our personal data online. I don't want them using my web history, email metadata, or video searches against me. That's why I use ExpressVPN every single time I go online. Right now, as I'm recording this podcast, I have ExpressVPN on. Big tech companies can match your internet activity to your identity or location using your public IP address. When I use ExpressVPN, these tech companies, they can't see my IP address at all. My identity is masked and anonymized by a secure VPN server. Plus, ExpressVPN has all the added benefits of encrypting 100% of your data to keep you safe from hackers and all the internet bad guys. Does that sound complicated? Well, it's not. I promise. ExpressVPN software takes just a minute to set up on your computer or phone. You tap one button and boom, you're protected. So if you're like me and you believe it, your internet data belongs to who? You. It belongs to you, not the tech elites. Guess what? ExpressVPN is the answer. ExpressVPN is the answer. Protect your online activity today and find out how you can get 3 months free at expressvpn.com/charlie. That's expressvpn.com/charlie. 3 months free with a 1-year package. Visit expressvpn.com/charlie to learn more. So we started off the show remembering 9/11 and talking about some of the domestic implications of the worst terrorist attack in American history and one of the worst, if not the worst, attack in American history on American citizens in a single day. But now I want to shift gears and talk about the international and the foreign policy implications, because there was just as much, if not even more, implications based on 9/11 of what happened overseas and abroad, using American lives, American resources, time, and treasure. And so as we talked about earlier in the show, we talked about the hijackers. 15 out of 19 of the hijackers was Saudi Arabian, and it was Saudi Arabian funded. It's also important to remember that Iran was also involved in 9/11. According to the New York Post, a top Iranian official has admitted for the first time that Iran knowingly helped al-Qaeda terrorists, including some of the 9/11 attackers, travel secretly through the Middle East. According to Mohammad Javid Larji, I'm pronouncing his name, Lajarjini, said in a recent interview, their movements were under the complete supervision of Iranian intelligence. This is all according to the New York Post. And so Saudi Arabia was behind it. Iran had something to do with it. The Taliban had something to do with it. But who did we end up attacking? Well, okay, so the Afghanistan war started on October 7th, 2001, less than a month after 9/11. It has claimed the lives of 2,372 American service people, the most recent of whom was Sergeant First Class Ellis and Angel Barreto Ortiz. I totally, totally apologize for the mispronunciation. Ellis Angel Barreto Ortiz was killed just this past Thursday by Taliban terrorists. And so most people believe the immediate Afghanistan war was a total appropriate response to 9/11. Now, look, right after 9/11, when America was ready for revenge and quick retaliation, less than a month after 9/11, we started strategic bombing campaigns and we sent in the special forces, and we got done more in 90 days after 9/11 in Afghanistan that we have got done in the last 20 years since, or last 18 years since. And that might be a big surprise for you to hear, but according to several security analysts and special force members that I have talked to and that I've met with intently on this topic, when we were highly focused and we were not top heavy with infrastructure and tanks and helicopters, and we brought in 500 of our top special forces guys that had blood in their eyes for revenge of what happened against us on 9/11, we went after terrorist site, and we were very, very successful. But then, like all government programs, we then decided to increase the amount of military personnel. We decided to essentially create a permanent occupying force in Afghanistan. So the military objectives of what became the Resolute Support Mission had the overarching goal to construct a security force of approximately 350,000 soldiers and policemen. Essentially, we were there to help the Afghanistan military and help the Afghanistan government against the Taliban. It's really important to remember, though, that we have been talking to the Taliban for 30 or 40 years. President Ronald Reagan met with the Taliban. We met with the Taliban all throughout the 1990s. Yes, the Taliban unforgivably gave space for the 9/11 terrorists to train. However, those people are no longer in charge of the Taliban today. It's a different people in charge of Taliban today. So after 17 years of engagement, 9 years of significant military training and financial support, the Afghan government can only claim control of most major cities, albeit with bombings all the time, frequent bombings, tenuous control of central provinces, and a ceding of significant swaths of rural territory to the Taliban. So just so you know what the Taliban is, they are a regional, mostly mountainous ruling group that is hot in the most extreme tribal theocratic ideology. They're highly oppressive to women. These are not good guys. But look, America should not go around the world looking to go after bad guys. That is not a role of U.S. foreign policy, especially invade and occupy them for 17 plus years, the longest war in American history. So we get attacked on 9/11. And then we have a disproportionate response that ends up in some form of permanent peacekeeping occupation in Afghanistan that has cumulatively cost us over 2.4 $2.4 trillion. If you add up the Iraq War and the Afghanistan War together, it costs us over $2.4 trillion. And so just to zero in on the numbers, we spend over $5 billion annually to try to build and sustain Afghan forces, which is more than their entire budget. It's more than the entire Afghan government budget on this. So why don't we go spend $5 billion on rebuilding the black community instead of the black community in America that is suffering horribly under Democrat rule, instead of spending $5 billion in Afghanistan on I'm not sure what. Why on earth are we in Afghanistan? I ask this question of senators and of pundits and quote-unquote experts all the time. $2.4 trillion spent in the Middle East that we know of, probably even more if you count the amount of PTSD and you count the amount of veteran suicides and all the financial implication costs around that. But $2.4 trillion, hundreds of billions of dollars of waste, money that we have no idea where it went at all altogether. What have we got to show for it? Let's cut to my interview with Senator Rand Paul, where he documents some of the waste in Afghanistan. If you haven't listened to my interview with Rand Paul, you can go down and listen to Renegade Rand Paul on the Charlie Kirk Show. Please give us 5 stars and hit subscribe. Let's cut to that sound of Rand Paul talking about some of the waste in Afghanistan.
We spent something like $90 million on a hotel across the street from our embassy that has 7,000 people in it. The hotel's not finished. The shell of a hotel. And someone ran with the money to Jordan or something. They fled.
Exactly right. Exactly right.
And then it's out to Taliban outpost where they shoot down at our embassy.
And
now we have to deconstruct.
And you know what the conclusion is going to be to this hotel? We're going to spend another couple hundred thousand to tear it down because it's a danger to our soldiers. But some guy got $90 million and ran off with it. There's another example from Afghanistan. They wanted to build a gas station for the Afghans. See, it's not about war. It's about building stuff for them. So, but because we're going green in the military, it's a natural gas station. How many people have a car in the audience that runs on natural gas? Nobody in America has a car that runs on natural gas. They're extraordinary if they exist. Nobody in Afghanistan even has a car. The average income is $800 a year. So nobody's got a car. They're burning campfires, all right? And so we built them a natural gas station. They had no cars, so we bought them some cars. We bought them 24 cars that run on natural gas, but they had no money, so we gave them a credit card to get the gas. But the gas station was supposed to cost about $500,000. It ended up costing $45 million because the contractors were ripping us off. So I had two members of my staff that said they'd go to Afghanistan to look at some of this waste. They got over there, and after 19 years, you can't drive in a car anywhere. You have to go by helicopter with Marines to protect you, even within the city of Kabul, the capital. So the gas station was out in the country, and they said, can we see it to see if it is functioning? What's a $45 million natural gas station doing? And they said, well, we just can't take the risk to go out there. It's not worth Americans dying to show you this gas station. So it's like we spent $45 million in an area of the country we can't even visit. See, this is crazy. No kids should be sent over to Afghanistan when there is no reason for the war anymore. We're building them gas stations and roads.
We are spending money on things halfway around the world while our country is $22 trillion in debt. So let me get this straight. We're $22 trillion in debt. We are now occupying a sovereign country. Why? Because they were somewhat involved in 9/11? Okay, that's unforgivable. Saudi Arabia was involved in 9/11. Iran was involved in 9/11. A lot of countries were involved in 9/11. So why do we go and permanently occupy those countries? I can't figure that out at all. 17 years of engagement, 9 years of significant military training and financial support, and we have nothing to show for it whatsoever. And in no way, I want to make myself perfectly clear, in no way am I at all for a second questioning the commitment, the sacrifice, or the focus of our veterans and of the people that have actually sacrificed their life and have spilled blood overseas. My critique is nowhere even close to being near the veterans and their commitment and their service to the country. Instead, it's to the politicians that keep on sending our amazing veterans and amazing soldiers to fight these endless and reckless wars overseas with no end and no victory in sight. So were the Taliban good people or are they good people? Of course not. But in the words of John Quincy Adams, this is one of my favorite quotes about foreign policy. America goes not abroad in search of monsters to destroy. There are bad people all across the world. It is not America's role to go occupy every portion of the world just because there are bad people there. And the Taliban had just basic, very basic regional ambitions. They weren't trying to take over the world. And by the way, they're mostly tribal. I mean, they've been there for a very, very long time. There's really no way to destroy them unless you're going, unless the only way to destroy the Taliban is if you're going to completely and totally carpet bomb the entire country of Afghanistan. And I don't support that, and no decent human being should ever support that whatsoever. The Afghanistan war was a strategic failure. It was not thought out where there was a victory in sight. And there is a common theme here. When America engages in these sorts of conflicts, such as the Vietnam War and the Iraq War and the Afghanistan War, where there is not clear victory in sight, we end up being a very expensive peacekeeping operation, which ends up in Americans dying and us spending trillions of dollars we do not have. And so even beyond that, if we just had the Afghanistan war failure, that would be bad enough. But I think one of the biggest failures of the Republican Party ever was the Iraq War. The Iraq War is an unacceptable military exercise that must be called out for what it really was. It was an overextension and an overly aggressive foreign policy doctrine that resulted in thousands of people dead, that resulted in hundreds of billions of dollars spent. And so I just want to read, and I don't agree at every part of this and every piece of language, but I think this is really interestingly well written by Major Danny Serson. I don't know if I'm saying that right, from Truth Dig. It's a great summation of the quagmire that is Iraq and the unexpected consequences of regime change. Begin quote. The story has been told so many times that the tragedy doesn't warrant a full recounting. Here's the short version. Poor intelligence and dubious evidence was used by a gang of neocon ideologues to sell Americans on the need for regime change in Iraq, a country that had not been involved in the 9/11 attacks. Pause. That is totally true, by the way. Totally true. Resume quote. Frightened, naive, and ill-informed, the American people and esteemed outlets like the New York Times went along for the ride. We were told it'd be a cakewalk and self-financing. It was neither. A civil war broke out. Tens of thousands of civilians and thousands of U.S. troops died. By the time I arrived in October 2006, the place was aflame. Fear not, we were told. Bush and his new brainy general, some Petraeus guy, would surge troops and win the day after all. Violence did briefly decline. The Iraqi government, however, failed to garner legitimacy. Still, we were told we won. The last American soldiers marched out in December 2011. A day later, the Shia prime minister tried to arrest the Sunni vice president. Sectarian relations soured again until a new version of an old group, ISIS, preyed on Sunni resentment and conquered a third of Iraq in 2014. The war hawks, Democrats and Republicans on Capitol Hill, squawked, and soon enough, U.S. planes, then boots, were guess where? Back in Iraq. It has been 15 years since Operation Iraqi Freedom, and there, in Iraq and Syria, U.S. servicemen remain wedged between Saudi-backed Sunni Islamists and Iranian-backed Shia militiamen. Some 4,500 American soldiers have already died, with upwards of 30,000 more wounded and countless with PTSD. I'm adding that last part. And like a bad sitcom, the U.S. military still spends most of its time fighting spin-off wars, Iraq, Syria, Iraq 2.0, Syria, ISIS, Yemen, so on and so forth, of the original Iraq disaster. That ill-fated farce of an invasion either created the conditions or exacerbated the existing tensions which informed today's regional wars. If Bin Laden himself had authored it, he could have hardly written a more dreadful quagmire for the United States military. Wow. So I don't agree with every word of that whole thing, but I agree with a lot of it. Major Danny Serson from Truth Dig. This has been a waste of money and a waste of time, and for what? And for those of you that might be disagreeing with me, I just have to ask a couple questions. Is America in a better and stronger place because of the Iraq and Afghanistan war? What have we as a country received in return for what we have contributed to the region since we started invading Iraq and Afghanistan? Are we a richer, safer, more secure country because of those two wars? Do we have a good handle on radical Islamic terrorism today, more so than before those wars? Let's talk about some of the numbers. These are just facts. Fact, 189,000. What is that? That's how many direct war deaths, which doesn't include the hundreds of thousands more that died due to war-related hardships. This includes Iraqi civilians and Iraqi citizens. 4,488. That's the number of U.S. service personnel killed directly. 4,488 United States service men and women no longer are living. That's moms, that's dads, that's sisters and brothers are dead because of a reckless war in Iraq. 32,223. What is that? That's how many troops were injured in Iraq, not including PTSD. 134,000? That's how many civilians were killed directly. 655,000? That's how many people have died in Iraq since the invasion that would not have died if the invasion had not occurred. 150? That's how many reporters were killed. 2.8 million? That's how many people who remain either internally displaced or have fled the country. 1.7 trillion? That's the amount in war expenses spent by the United States Treasury Department as through fiscal year 2013. An extraordinary number, an unacceptable number when the country is $22 trillion in debt. That's $5,000? That's the amount spent per second on the Iraq war. $350,000, the cost to deploy one American military member. $490 billion, the amount in war benefits owed to war veterans. $7 trillion, the projected interest payments due by 2053 because the war was paid for with borrowed money. $20 billion, the amount paid to KBR, the contractor responsible for equipment and services. $3 billion, the amount of KBR payments Pentagon auditors considered questionable. $60 billion, the amount paid for reconstruction, which was ruled largely a waste due to corruption and shoddy work. $4 billion, the amount owed to the United States by Iraq before the invasion. 1.6 million, gallons of oil used by U.S. forces each day in Iraq. That was about $127 per barrel. And the numbers go on and on and on. 189,000 direct war deaths, 4,488 U.S. service personnel killed directly. 4,488 people no longer live because of the reckless war in Iraq. And look, putting myself in the shoes after 2001, after 9/11, and by the way, that list was originally created by Business Insider to cite it, just to kind of put myself in the shoes, I understand that people were angry and people were scared and people wanted justice after 9/11. We are a weaker country because of the Iraq war and because of the Afghanistan war. We invaded Iraq, a country that was keeping Iran, probably our greatest enemy today on the planet, besides China. China's number one, Iran is number two. We displaced Saddam Hussein, who was a bad guy, but was fighting Iran with us all the time, for us. Saddam was fighting Iran all the time. The Iran-Iraq war was happening, and we were fine with it. I mean, it was two countries that we didn't like that were fighting each other. We displaced a dictator, we created a power vacuum, and we made Iran stronger because of it. So now, as things stand today, President Donald Trump, our great and terrific president, his instincts are totally and completely correct. When he was running for the presidency of the United States, he asked the question, why are we still in Afghanistan? He is angling towards an end to the war in Afghanistan, a war that has cost far too much money and too many American lives. So let's first begin the question with, when is it right to end a war? I think the burden of continuing the war has to be on the people who are pushing to continue to keep the war going. I've listened to their arguments, and I am not moved, and I find them very, very uncompelling. Based on their argument, they say that we have to fight the bad guys there so that we don't fight them here. First of all, the logic, if you extrapolate that to its furthest possible conclusion, we should just go fight every bad person around the world. To use John Quincy Adams' quote again, America goes not abroad in search of monsters to destroy. But is the Taliban really the greatest threat against America then? I mean, if we should fight them there so we don't fight them here, then we should be deploying U.S. troops fighting everywhere all across the world if they dare look at us horribly. And that doesn't count the financial cost or the cultural cost or the displacement and the power vacuums that that might create. And according to Aquinas, the great thinker who had the just war theory, it's not correct to invade a sovereign nation just because they have different values than you. The Taliban was tangentially involved in 9/11 alongside Iran, alongside Saudi Arabia? That is undeniable. But is that worth a 17-year war? Of course not. Here's something that we have to accept, and the Cato Institute published a very thoughtful piece on this. The United States can't win against the Taliban at a remotely acceptable cost. And look, we as Americans should be unafraid to say this. This does not make you un-American. This does not make you as if you believe that America's become weak. It just makes that you're. It just means you're very. You're making an honest assessment of the tribal implications of the Taliban's occupancy of the mountain hills of Afghanistan. Do we really want to be involved in that? I mean, look, history demonstrates that indigenous and armed groups tend to be more committed to their country than foreign military occupiers. Afghans, in particular, have a long history of resisting intruders, ousting the British twice in the 19th century and once in the 20th century, and pushing out the Soviets at the end of the 1980s. Afghanistan's landlocked geography, mountainous terrain, and porous borders complicate attempts at military domination from the outside while giving an advantage to guerrilla insurgents. I couldn't have said it better myself. And so after 17 years, the Taliban still has not gone away. We spent all this money, lost all these lives. What does success look like? To all the permanent war advocates out there, what does success look like? And I have not heard an answer that I find to be compelling whatsoever when I ask that. And unless we're willing to commit a couple $1 trillion and annex Afghanistan as one of our own states to foolish ideas, it is time to end the war in Afghanistan. The second point that is made by the Cato Institute very thoughtfully, a Taliban victory would not present a serious terrorism threat to the United States. It's just totally true. I mean, look, the Taliban, again, the argument to continue there is that this was a sanctuary for transnational extremists, as it was when the 9/11 attacks were planned there. If that was the case, then we should also invade and occupy Pakistan. Pakistan was harboring Osama bin Laden. If that was the case, we should also occupy Iran and Saudi Arabia. In fact, let's occupy the entire Middle East, right? If that was really the argument against it, then there shouldn't be a sovereign country in the Middle East that we shouldn't be afraid to invade. That isn't Israel, essentially. Israel or Jordan. And every single country in the Middle East that we should invade. There are limitations on our financial capabilities, and honestly, there are limitations on our military capabilities. We are a weaker country when we fight these reckless and endless wars. Great countries do not fight endless wars. This is no longer a war. This is now basically a community peacekeeping operation with IEDs on the side of the road that put our American service members in very difficult scenarios without a clear purpose to achieve victory. President Trump, of course, made news over the weekend when he publicly announced he had canceled a secretly called for meeting with the Taliban leaders to take place on U.S. soil this last Sunday. And look, I totally support the president meeting with the Taliban. End the war. Bring the troops home. We have no idea what success looks like. And I see these people. I'm just watching my muted television right now. I see some people on cable TV, and I know what they're saying because I can see the subtitles, that we can't embody weakness in the Middle East and that we can't dare back off an inch. Like, really? Really? I mean, and look, the critics say that I'm legitimizing the Taliban. We negotiated with the Taliban all throughout the 80s and the 90s. And guess what? If it means that we have to pull out from Afghanistan to legitimize some sort of tribal group that has resisted the Soviet Union and the British twice in the 19th century and is continuing to bankrupt our country morally and financially, then so what? So be it. It is not in the best interest of our country to continue to permanently occupy a foreign country. We have enough problems here at home without us having to worry about being a police peacekeeping operation halfway around the world. So as we remember 9/11, and we remember who was behind it, and we remember the heroes of that day in Flight 93, and we remember with a reverent tone, and we just pray for the families, and we pray for the victims of that horrible, horrible day, let's also this day call for President Trump to end the war in Afghanistan. Completely to withdraw from Afghanistan. It will not make us weaker. It will not make us more likely towards terrorist attack. It is the correct choice to make. On this anniversary of 9/11, we should call on President Trump to end the war in Afghanistan. Bring home the 14,000 active duty members deployed. It'll save money. It'll save us militarily. And guess what? The experts have gotten it wrong for 18 years. We need a new approach. The generals have had their chance to try to demonstrate what success looks like in Afghanistan. And guess what? They have failed. It's not disrespectful to the lives lost to pull out of Afghanistan. It's honoring to the lives that will not be lost in the future. The future service members, the future brothers and sisters, wives and husbands that are there right now or could potentially be there. I do not want to see another American life lost trying to fight an endless and reckless war halfway around the world when no one knows what success looks like, no one knows what victory looks like. This anniversary, 9/11, let's unequivocally end the longest war in American history that has put us in debt and lost thousands of American lives. It takes more courage to end a war than to continue one. President Trump, we know you're going to do the right thing to end the endless war in Afghanistan. Thank you so much, everybody, for listening to this edition of the Charlie Kirk Show. Do your part today to remember the heroes on 9/11 and our amazing veterans that served overseas and lost their lives defending the greatest country ever to exist in the history of the world. And I hope our show and our contribution here can prevent these politicians from continuing these wars overseas, especially in the Middle East. Make us weaker. It puts us in a less advantageous situation, both financially and militarily. We are the greatest country ever to exist in the history of the world, thanks large in part to our veterans, and we owe it to them and to future veterans not to put them in harm's way over a 17-year failed war in the Middle East. Please give us 5 stars, everybody. Leave us a review. Press subscribe. Get your friend to do the same. Support our sponsors. We are surging in the charts, large in part thanks to all your help. And signing off to next time, this is Charlie Kirk, host of The Charlie Kirk Show, your home of conservative, libertarian, rational thinking. Thank you so much, everybody.
Hey, everybody, it's Laura Ingraham, and I'd like to invite you to check out my new show, The Laura Ingraham Podcast, exclusively on Podcast One. So join me 3 days a week as I cover politics, the culture, everything in between, laugh, learn, all at the same time. We got you locked and loaded, and you'll be ready for the week, ready for the month. And it's very easy. You just subscribe today, download new episodes exclusively at podcastone.com or wherever you find your favorite podcast. And you know mine's going to be one of your newest.